Chapter 8. As Quartermoon drew closer, I was almost starting to enjoy myself at the academy. It still wouldn't have been my first choice of a home, but at least I was settling in. Once I'd stopped playing stupid in my engineering classes, they were actually sort of fun. And although I wasn't quite sure when it had happened, I was realizing that Rap and I were something like friends. I still hated the tunics, and I still hated how seriously everyone took themselves around here. But I understood it now. You've got to believe in something. I still felt sort of trapped, but it didn't feel quite as much like forever. That's because I finally had something to look forward to. Devectra's concert at the Chimera. I was going to ditch my butt-ugly tunic, sneak off campus, and sneak into the club. Yes, I knew that if I got caught, none of my technical skills and no amount of groveling would save me from a fate worse than the Kabarak. I also knew that Devectra hadn't really even invited me in the first place. Neither of those things mattered. First off, I wasn't going to get caught. Second, it didn't matter whether Devectra had been totally sincere. She had invited me knowing there would be no way for me to actually go. I figured if I pulled off the impossible, she'd have to be impressed. It was a big task, but I was up to it. Planning it had been my main source of entertainment ever since I'd come back from the trip with Daxon. It had even gotten my mind off the nagging worry that I was missing something around here. That something wasn't quite right. The first thing I'd done was to scope out the nighttime security situation at the academy. That wasn't so hard, because it turned out there basically wasn't any. Students weren't allowed to leave the grounds after dark, but all the other students here were so boring and committed that no one bothered actually enforcing it. There were no security guards, no cameras, no sensors, no nothing. They didn't exactly advertise it, but it was honor system all the way. The more complicated part of my plan would be Daxon. I'd done a little spying on him, and had discovered that he had a single occupancy bedroom down the hall from me, and a habit of going to bed early. I'd briefly worried that Daxon, as an active mentor Sepan, might have the privilege of a lock on his dorm room. But on the last night before Quartermoon, I snuck out of my room at midnight, crept down the hall, and quietly tried turning the knob. It opened without any resistance at all. After listening carefully for the sound of his snoring, I crept into the room and approached Daxon's bed. There it was. His ID band was lying right there next to his pillow. And he was curled up next to it, sawing logs, oblivious to my presence. This was going to be too easy. The following night, I would sneak in, snatch the ID band, commandeer the egg from the transport hangar. I had already covertly preset the time and coordinates for my departure, and make my way to the Chimera for Devectra's performance. Then I'd sneak back, return the egg to transport, return Daxon's ID band to his pillow, and no one would be any the wiser for my absence. Sneaking around, conniving, scheming, it would be just like the good old days. The Saturday of Quartermoon was my best day yet. A half day of classes followed by a quick workout in the gym and an early dinner in the commissary. A professor had authorized a screening during mealtime of an intercepted satellite transmission of a visual entertainment from the planet Earth. It might have been an overall pretty crappy place to live, but they sure knew how to do their visual entertainment right. Although the transmission was video only, I had seen my share of Earth intercepts and had no problem following the story. It wasn't really that complicated, at all. A well-dressed man traveled the world, hung out with beautiful women, snuck around to retrieve valuable objects, chased and got chased by bad guys. While watching the movie, I thought, I want to be like him one day. But then, taking another bite of my dessert and smiling up at the screen, I realized that I already was. The egg handled like a dream. Despite its silly name, it was a sleek and sexy machine, especially from behind the steering wheel. Not that different from the transports in the Earth movie I'd watched earlier that day. I had pre-programmed the journey so it would start at my command, but once I'd snuck into transport, and slipped inside the vehicle. It occurred to me that would create a potentially incriminating log of my route. So once I'd started the engine, I deleted the pre-programmed route and began my trip to the capital manually. Whizzing out of the hangar and through the Alwan Kabarak, I felt grateful for that decision. Driving the Egg was a lot more fun than sitting back and letting the car do all the work. While the LDA campus was quiet and sleepy at that hour, just like at any other hour, really, the Kabarak was in full swing for the quartermoon festivities as I passed over it. The Chimera had been let out of their pens and were frolicking freely, while the Kabarakians ringed around campfires in the dark, laughing and dancing, and shooting off fireworks and waving sparklers. I knew that behind me, from Alwan to Tarakas, from Dalun to the Outer Territories, people would be celebrating until dawn. But the sights and sounds of revelry diminished as I crossed the border into the city, where the quartermoon holiday was observed, with less enthusiasm. One hand on the wheel, I removed my tunic and threw it on the passenger seat, revealing the contraband Kelvaka t-shirt I was wearing underneath. I was still wearing what Devectra had called my pajama pants, but they really weren't so bad without the tunic. Around my wrist, the bulk of Daxon's ID band made a striking counterpoint to the rest of my ensemble. All in all, I looked pretty good. Not that it even mattered that much how I looked. What mattered was that I'd gotten out. My escape had gone so smoothly that I almost felt guilty. I'd made such quick fools of everyone at the LDA, none of whom had any reason to suspect that my changed attitude was due in large part to the planning and execution of this grand deception. But before I could succumb to guilt or regret, I was distracted by the spires of Elkin on the horizon, which were lit up in pink by the mysterious column of light behind them. This time, I didn't pay them any attention. I was almost there. At the Chimera, the ID band worked like a charm. No one even looked at me sideways as I glided in. I was almost offended. Had they forgotten me so quickly? Maybe they just didn't recognize me anymore. I felt more confident than ever, like a totally different person from the one who, at the first sign of trouble, had gone pushing through the crowd like a frightened little kid just a few weeks ago. It had hardly been any time at all, but I felt like I'd grown up so much since then. The club was packed tonight, almost twice as busy as the last time I'd been here, which was saying something. Devectra's appearance weeks ago had been a surprise, but this quartermoon performance was well publicized, and it had attracted an even wider audience. I spotted homemade Devectra t-shirts on every fifth patron. The Chimera was the largest club on Lorien by far, and she had filled it to capacity. I felt a surge of pride. I'd known that Devectra was a big deal and all, but I hadn't known how big of a deal she was until now. And I knew her. You could almost even say we were friends.
Well, well, well.
I turned to see Paxton and Teeve holding up half-finished ampules and staring at me with amused grins on their faces.
Look who doesn't give up,
Teeve said, draping her arm around me and greeting.
After we saw you get busted last time, we figured we'd seen the last of you.
I just shrugged and smiled my cagiest smile, and they looked at me, for the first time, as if they were actually sort of impressed. I was just about to pat myself on the back for it when I heard a voice I recognized.
Someone told me you might have found your way in here somehow.
I turned around to see Merkel, Devectra's perpetually annoyed right-hand man, standing behind me with an ampule in each hand. He looked me up and down with predictably annoyed eyes.
Hey, Merkel,
I said in the most casual tone I could muster. My heart was thumping in my chest, knowing that if Merkel was talking to me, I was one step closer to seeing Devectra again. But I played it cool for the benefit of Teeve and Paxton. I wanted them to think it was no biggie for me to be on a first-name basis with a member of the headlining performer's entourage. I snuck a glance in their direction and saw that they were looking at me with stunned eyes. Mission accomplished.
Devectra wants to see you, he said.
As well as things had been going tonight, I still hadn't expected it to be this easy. How had Devectra even known I was here? Merkel must have seen the surprise on my face.
Telepathy, remember? Neat little trick to have.
I think you know where the dressing room is.
Here, bring her these.
He pushed the ampules into my hands and began to walk away.
You're not coming in?
I asked him, suddenly nervous about waltzing into Devectra's dressing room unaccompanied. It seemed too good to be true. With Devectra, you never knew what you were getting into.
He turned, looked over his shoulder, and waved me off. I'm on a break. Those ampules were my last errand for her until showtime.
He smiled wryly.
She's all yours.
Then he disappeared into the crowd. Devectra faced her reflection in the vanity mirror, her back to the door. She was wearing slim-fitting red metallic pants and a shimmering top made out of a liquid-like material that I'd never seen before. Her shirt flowed around the curves of her body in undulating cascades as she stood tall, stared straight ahead, and gently massaged her temples with her fingers. She didn't acknowledge me, but she knew I was here. Last time I'd been in this room, I'd had to bust through the entrance with all the strength I could muster. This time, I hadn't even had to knock. The door had just swung open for me as I'd approached it, clutching the ampules Merkel had given me to deliver. It suddenly occurred to me that maybe Devectra had used her telekinesis to help me get through the locked door last time, too. It was ironic that I'd been more comfortable making my entrance breaking down a door and crashing through an entire rack of clothes than I was just walking right in. I just stood there, feeling a few steps beyond awkward as Devectra gazed at herself in the mirror and rubbed her forehead.
Did you bring them?
She asked, without turning.
Yeah, I said. I walked over and handed her an ampule.
She took it, downed it in one gulp, then reached out for the second, and downed that too. She still hadn't bothered to look at me. When she tossed the second spent vial aside and onto the floor, I understood what her deal was. I had to hold back a laugh. For once, I was the one who knew what she was thinking instead of the other way around. Or, at least, I knew what she was feeling. You didn't need to be a telepath to figure it out.
Wow, you're actually nervous, I said.
So? She finally turned her attention from the mirror and locked her gaze on mine. Her eyes were hard, but underneath the steel I saw a hint of fear, of vulnerability.
Who wouldn't be?
You weren't nervous last time, I pointed out. I didn't know you got nervous. I kind of thought that was, like, your whole thing.
Last time was different.
Why?
It just was, she said. It was a smaller crowd. It wasn't Quartermoon. It was just different. Plus, there's just something about tonight. I don't know. I sort of have a bad feeling, I guess.
It's just nerves, I said.
I know. I'll be fine.
Then it was like I wasn't there anymore. Devectra's attention was back on herself as she ran her fingers through her hair and gingerly began to pile it, one tendril at a time, on top of her head. Each carefully arranged lock somehow managed to stay perfectly in place. She looked more frightened than ever. I didn't know what to say, so I decided to try something else. I decided not to talk. Out loud, at least. How does it work? I thought. Can you hear everything I think? What about the people outside? Can you hear them? What about the whole world? Can you hear them all? Devectra's lips didn't move. But she answered me anyway, in a voice I heard inside my head that was both hers and not hers. It's like standing waist-deep in a rushing river, and trying to catch a million tiny floating leaves as they race past you. Some of them you catch, most of them you don't. You invited me here tonight and summoned me back here. But why me? I wanted to know. Who am I to you? You're Devectra. I'm a nobody in a green tunic. No, you're like me. You're different. Neither of us fit in on this world. I knew it as soon as I met you. Before I met you, I knew. I sensed you out there in the crowd that first night. All those people and their thoughts all zooming past me, except yours. Yours just bubbled up, and I could reach down and pull up each one like every fear and hope you had was meant for me. It sounded like you were singing. But what about tonight? I had to know. Why am I here now? I knew you would make me feel less alone. Especially tonight. I can feel that something terrible is about to happen.
I looked over. Devectra was staring at my reflection in the mirror. She had the strangest look on her face, both peaceful and surprised. Something told me that she'd never done this before, had never used her legacy to speak to someone wordlessly like this. I knew then, without understanding why, that this might be the only chance I ever got. So I leaned over, closed my eyes, and kissed her. Her lips were soft, and she smelled like something I recognized, but couldn't describe, even to myself. Her lips tasted like something I'd tasted in a dream, one of those dreams you forget as soon as you wake up. When I opened my eyes, she was gone.
Chapter 9. "Daloon this time of year is miserable," said the guy. "You couldn't pay me all the money in the world."
"No argument there, bro," I said, even though I'd never been to Daloon. I truly didn't want to argue. I was on the balcony above the stage, waiting with Merkel and the rest of the entourage for Devectra's performance to start. She was behind schedule, but most of the people on the balcony were pretty buzzed, and no one seemed impatient, least of all me. Instead, I just felt strange. I was lightheaded and euphoric. I didn't know where Devectra had gone after she'd left me, but even after her warning, "Something terrible is about to happen," I wasn't worried about her. My brain was still buzzing, turning loops and cartwheels on itself. Our kiss had been incredible, but it was the telepathic rapport that we'd shared that I was still reeling from. Speaking only with our minds, we'd managed to communicate on a level more pure, more real, than anything I'd ever experienced. No kiss could ever compare to that. The lights finally came down on the club, and as they did, a spotlight, positioned stage center, took shape, a blindingly white oval. Every single person in the place gazed into the brightness, our breaths all held together in anticipation of what was coming next. Then came a sound, a thin, heartbreakingly fragile warble. It seemed to be coming from inside that small pool of light. As the warble grew in volume and intensity, never losing any of its beautiful fragility, the disc of the spotlight began to bend and twist, as if willing itself to break. Where was Devectra? It sounded like she was somewhere inside that orb of light. The light kept rising off the stage floor, and the voice contained inside it rose in pitch. It stopped, hovering in the exact center of the club, only yards away from where I stood at the edge of the mezzanine. It was so bright it hurt to look at, but I couldn't pull away. The volume and pitch rose and rose. Some members of the crowd plugged their ears from Devectra's sonic drill. But still no one dared to look away from the ball of light. Then it exploded. Suddenly light was everywhere. There wasn't a single shadow left anywhere in the usually shadowy club.
People spun around, dazed, staring at their fellow concertgoers with new eyes. Every pore on every face was exposed, illuminated. The sound of De Vectra's voice had shattered, too, into tiny cascading tinkles, equal in volume at any point with the club space.
"There she is," said a voice in the crowd.
De Vectra stood above the crowd, her crowd. Not on the stage, but on top of the bar near the entrance. The tinkling sounds evaporated from the air like smoke. She had been throwing her voice and shaping it into that orb of light the entire time. All the while, no one had noticed she'd been somewhere else. It was amazing, and she was only getting started. De Vectra stepped forward off the bar and walked through the crowd towards the stage. Under normal circumstances, people would have been clamoring and elbowing each other, rushing forward to get closer to the performer. But they stepped back to let her through, still in awe of what they'd just seen. She began to sing. No microphone, no amplification, no legacy-assisted manipulation. She just sang. No one in the audience made a sound. Her voice came through as clear as a bell. This wasn't one of her usual dance numbers. It was a simple song, and a sad one. I barely understood the words, but I knew that it was a song of love and loss. She stepped onto the stage without missing a beat, and then turned back to her audience, her eyes sparkling with tears. I was rapt. I wondered what she was singing about. I couldn't help wondering if she was singing about me. I didn't have to wonder, really. I knew. It was about me, but it wasn't. She was singing for me. The sadness at the heart of the song was bigger than any one or any two Lorik. It was as big as the planet itself. It was a song for Lorien. As entranced as I was, I jumped when I felt something vibrating at my wrist. I looked down in surprise, forgetting that I still wore Daxon's ID band. It was rattling, buzzing urgently. I silenced it and turned back to the stage. De Vectra was still singing, her eyes closed. The band vibrated again. I pulled the ID band off to inspect it to figure out why it was rattling so insistently. As I held it in both hands, the vibrating band tickling the bones of my fingers, I inspected the digital interface. The small rectangular screen was blinking, as was the single word, alert. Panic began to rise in my chest. Maybe Daxon had woken up, seen his missing ID band, and triggered some kind of alarm. Maybe I'd been caught. No. I knew somehow that the alert signaled something far worse than that. I thought of the control panel outside the club just weeks before, about the sorry state of the grid. I thought of Daxon in the egg, behaving as if something was seriously wrong. I thought of the unexplained column of light. And I thought of the elder prophecy I'd been ignoring my whole life. One day, a great threat will come. And I thought of De Vectra. Something terrible is about to happen. My knees went weak. I looked up to hear her finishing her beautiful song. De Vectra closed her mouth. The song ended. The crowd held its applause, fearful of breaking the spell. And then, the roof came down. Chapter 10. Returning to consciousness, I took inventory. Blackness. Silence. And there it was. Pain. I forced myself up through the blackness, clutching blindly forward with my hands. I felt smashed stone, the wetness of my own blood in my palms, the acrid tang of smoke against my still, sightless eyes. Sound returned faster than vision. It was a ringing in my ears, the exact opposite of the hypnotic, unfettered emotion of De Vectra's music. This was concussive, ear-splitting. In agony, I clutched my head to force it out, but the pain kept rising. The club had been bombed. Then more sound emerged through the tinnitus-like buzz. Moaning, screaming, crying. I turned my head left and right, trying to find a source of light, anything to help me figure out what had just happened. That's when I saw the fire, rising up the entrance wall, small, but getting bigger. It wasn't until I tried to stand that I realized I was on the ground floor of the club, not on the mezzanine. I turned around and saw that the entire balcony had been knocked from its struts, smashed like a dropped dinner plate on the floor of the club. No, I thought, no. Not just on the floor of the club, on top of a mass of crushed concertgoers. They were already dead. The stage was intact, as was the other half of the dance floor that hadn't gotten buried by the collapsing mezzanine. But the people there hadn't been spared. The sheer force of the blast, in combination with the shrapnel from the shattered roof, had killed most of the audience members who hadn't been crushed. Bodies littered the floor, while bloody and dazed survivors struggled to their feet from out of the sea of corpses. My leg was stuck, wedged between two crushed stones. I feared it was broken or worse, but I needed to get up. Devectra, I thought. I needed to know she was okay. I strained against the rubble, but it wouldn't give. I looked around for something I could use to pull myself out. That's when I saw the guy I'd been talking to only minutes ago, the one who didn't like Dalune this time of year. He was flat on the ground, the balcony a broken jigsaw beneath him. His eyes were wide open, his body eerily intact except for his jaw, which had been sheared clean off by shrapnel. I turned away from the grisly sight and felt a hand on my shoulder. Merkel stood above me, a shocked look on his face, and caked in dust, but apparently unharmed by the explosion. Help? He said. In my confusion, I froze, unable to decide if he was asking for help or offering it. Merkel didn't wait for me to figure it out. He crouched down by my side and looked around, determining which rock to lift in order to free me. His slender arms looked weak, but when they found the chunk of rubble that trapped my leg, he pulled it away like it was nothing at all. I stared down at my knee. It was bloody and bruised, but not broken. I was going to be okay. Without knowing where I found the strength to do it, I stood up, first on my strong leg, and then on my tingly weak one, wobbling on the uneven rubble beneath me. I turned to thank Merkel. He had already disappeared into the mass of wailing, screaming, and silent shell-shocked survivors. I looked towards the entrance. There was no entrance anymore. The doors and entire front wall of the club were now nothing more than an orange raging inferno. My forehead prickled with sweat. The fire exit. It was the only way out. Or it would have been. The fire exit had only been accessible from the balcony. I felt all hope slip out of me like a vapor. Then I saw a few survivors crowding at the base of the wall, below the escape. Despite the balcony's collapse, the struts, a few chunks of concrete, and some girders remained at the base of the exit. It was enough. Barely. The survivors were hurriedly scrambling against the wall, grabbing onto whatever handholds they could manage, and hoisting themselves out of the burning club. I was torn. I knew I had to run to save myself. And still I couldn't. I wanted to find Devectra. I was still trying to make a choice when I saw her shiny red pants sliding up the wall and out of the exit. After all that, she hadn't thought twice about taking her first chance to safety. Had it even occurred to her to look for me? There was nothing keeping me here now. I ran to the crowd at the base of the wall. I tried to resist casting one glance back at the smoky, bloody, ruined club,
don't look back. But I looked back, and my eyes went straight to him. It was Paxton. He was alive, but he was just crouched on the ground in despair, rocking back and forth. I knew I was being an idiot, but I didn't care. Without thinking twice, I gave up my place at the back of the line and rushed over to help him. As I got closer, I understood why he had given up. At his feet, crushed by concrete, was Teve. I grabbed his hand and tried urging him on towards the exit, but he wouldn't budge. His eyes met mine.
"She's stuck," he said.
"Teve, we have to get her out." I didn't need to look down to know that Teve was dead. Paxton didn't get it, though. "I'm sorry," I said, "but there's no time. We have to go now." Slowly, he began to move away from the corpse of the girl I'd once had a crush on, the girl he had loved. I pushed him forward over the balcony's rubble, trying not to imagine all the Lorik bodies mangled and bloody beneath the stone. We were the last two up the wall. As I pushed Paxton up and out of the exit, I spotted Daxon's band poking out of the rubble a few yards away. I must have dropped it when the roof caved in and the balcony collapsed. The smoke was overwhelming, and the flames had nearly reached the exit, but I took one last risk anyway. I lunged for it. I put the band back on my wrist, leapt up the wall, and crawled out into the night. On the street, a bloody woman in tattered clothes milled among the survivors.
"Devectra tried to kill us," she screamed. "Devectra did it!"
She was clearly hysterical, and most of the people gathered around her were far too shocked by the explosion to pay her much heed. But a few people seemed to be nodding in agreement. The shock was only just now hitting me. There was something about the stillness, the ordinariness, of the street outside the club that truly made me understand the horror of what I'd just escaped. The band was vibrating on my wrist again. Alert! 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 Devectra was nowhere to be seen among the survivors. She hadn't hesitated for a second or stopped to help anyone. She'd gotten her sparkly red ass out of there. Still, despite the screaming woman and the hushed murmurs of the crowd, I knew Devectra hadn't been the cause of the explosion. She had even tried to warn me about it, sort of. In her own way, she had tried to warn us all. With that song. She just hadn't known she was doing it, I don't think. It hadn't been her. They were right all along, I thought. Everything I had learned at the LDA, the grid, the prophecy, our sacred duty to safeguard our perfect planet, it had all turned out to be true. There was some force willing and able to bring our entire planet down after all. This was the first strike. A Munis vehicle had double-parked outside the club, and its driver was rushing to attend the victims. I climbed up the side of the truck to get a better view of the city. It was as I'd feared. Everywhere I looked on the horizon, I could make out the site of yet another destroyed landmark. The North Arena, my former school, they were all burning. I turned around. There was no smoke, but the spires of Elkin, the largest structures on Lorien and home to almost a third of the city's population, were gone too, leaving a soul-shattering void in the skyline. With no obstruction, I stared up at the column of violet light pulsing malevolently on the horizon. That was no herald. In a burst of understanding, I saw it all clearly. If only I hadn't been so convinced that everyone at the LDA was a self-important fool, I would have seen it so much sooner. It was obvious now. The column of light was responsible for the grid's burnout. Whoever had just attacked us
must have known about the weaknesses in the grid, and sent that light down to screw with our only mechanical form of defense. It had been draining our defenses this whole time. I clutched my head, my heart thumping in my chest. The attackers had sent missiles through the holes in the grid, targeting high-density structures like the Chimera and the spires. I had just replaced the wiring in this sector days ago, but the security patches were interdependent, and I knew there were outages all over the city. We'd been unprotected. It was as clear a night as I'd seen in a while. There were no clouds at all, just smoke, flame, and the brilliant blue light of the quarter moon. I couldn't take any more. I jumped down from the Munis vehicle and raced to the egg, which I found still parked exactly where I'd left it. Amazingly, it was all in one piece. I had to get back to the academy, or whatever was left of it. I had to explain my theory to whoever would listen. Surely the council and the academy faculty had been apprised of the attacks on the city, and Daxon would be awake, wondering where his ID band was. As I opened the door to the egg, I heard a voice. "Sandor." I turned around. Devectra and Merkel stood in the shadows. I had never seen Devectra look so lost before, not even during her little panic attack before the show. All the anger and betrayal I'd felt toward her just minutes ago disappeared as soon as we collapsed into each other's arms. After just a moment, she pushed me away and shook her head sadly. "I just came to say goodbye. I know we won't see each other again. Whatever this thing is, Sandor, it's bad. It's the thing they warned us about. I'm going to find some of my guard friends, and we're going to do whatever we can to stop it." Merkel had been standing there the whole time, but he was staring straight ahead, with a dead look in his eyes. Whatever fight he'd had in him looked like it was long gone now. "Let me come with you," I said. "I can help." Devectra shook her head. "No. We have to do it on our own." She looked at the band on my wrist. "There are people who need you more than I do right now." She was right, but I wasn't ready. Not yet. Tears were streaming down my face. I tried to fight them back. There was no time for crying. "Why did you leave me in there?" I knew the answer. It didn't matter. I had to ask anyway. Devectra put a finger to my lips, as if to say, "Listen carefully." "I left because I was scared, Sandor," she said. At least, I think she said it. "We were never perfect. There's no such thing as perfect. But it's not too late for us. We can still be good." Chapter 11. I programmed the egg to return me to the LDA on autopilot. In the driver's seat, I folded my arms across my chest and stared straight ahead. I didn't want to see the devastation as I passed my charred school or any of the other now ruined landmarks of my home city. But even with this cultivated tunnel vision, I couldn't help noticing the smoke coming from the Elder Gardens. "Hundreds must be dead," I thought. I closed my eyes. I didn't want to think about it. I just wanted to get back to the LDA, to do something. I opened my eyes as the egg passed through Alwan. Chimera still frolicked by the light of the campfire, and the Kabarakians clustered together in merriment. They were unaware of the destruction to their west. It wouldn't be long before they found out. The first thing I had to do was make sure Academy officials and council members were even aware of the attack on the city. I was pretty sure they were, but even so, it was still possible I had first-hand information that would be important somehow. I would confess to having snuck out and brief them on my experience of the attack. I'd share my theory that the column was some kind of attack
intended to disarm the grid in advance of the wave of missile attacks that had decimated our city. Once that was accomplished, I would locate Daxon, apologize for taking his ID band, and return it to him. Then there was Rapp. I had to make sure he was okay. I smelled it before I saw it. A coppery, dusty tang in the air, somehow strong enough to reach me even through the egg's high-grade air filters. The first thing I actually saw was an absence. The LDA building, the hangar, and the council chamber behind it were all usually bathed in security lights. But as the egg approached the Academy's coordinates, I saw nothing but blackness. The Academy had been hit. The egg whirred to a halt in the darkness. "Journey complete," read the dashboard monitor. Dazed, I stepped out into the eerie blackness of the night. As my eyes adjusted, I began to make out tiny shards of light on the ground. It was all gone. Razed. The entire structure had been pummeled into the ground by a weapon the likes of which I had never even imagined. The entire campus had been crushed and melted simultaneously. The green-tinged shards of light I was looking at were the smoldering edges of this black, toxic pancake on Lorien's surface. "Hundreds more," I thought, stumbling back and forth over the black crust, looking for some unruined piece of the campus, and finding none. My professors, the tech students, the Mentor Sapon trainees, and the resident Mentor Sapons. All those guard children. Orkin. Daxon. Rapp. I fell to my knees on the crust. It was warm, ash black, but surprisingly soft. This time, I allowed myself to cry. "How could I let this happen?" I thought. The fumes rising from the crust, probably chemicals from the bomb mixed with whatever debris the Academy's destruction had unleashed, burned my throat and my eyes. I didn't budge. "Let them kill me," I thought. I had no plan, no home to return to. I could go to my parents. Dalun, a minor city on the other end of the planet, was probably safe. But for how long? And even if it remained untouched, the thought of programming the egg to take me there, of spending the rest of my life with my parents in their two-bedroom chalet in bourgeois seclusion made me ill. The only things I had ever cared about were gone. The worst part was that I'd never even really known I'd cared. With my head pressed against my knees, still fuzzy and throbbing from the rising vapors, my ears suddenly pricked. I heard something approaching, a vehicle. "The attackers," I thought. "The ground invasion has begun." I had no weapons, no means of defense. The attackers, whoever they were probably coming to make sure they'd left no survivors at their target. When they found me, they would kill me. This had been my home. Not just the school, but the whole planet. I had been too busy wanting it to be something it wasn't that I had never realized all the ways in which it was mine. Maybe there was nothing I could do. I was just one Sapon with a busted leg, with no legacies, and not even a weapon. I stood up anyway, turned around to face whoever it was head on, and prepared to fight. The footsteps approaching me were heavy and purposeful, and as they got louder, the melody from Devectra's final song came back to me. I began to hum, but before I could see my enemy, I had collapsed. Chapter 12.
I felt myself lifted from the ground and carried to a vehicle. I was thrown inside and landed with a thump on my back. I heard the sound of the door buzzing shut and felt the transport lurch as it speedily resumed its course on autopilot, throwing me hard against the back. The lights came on, and the world around me began to blur back into focus. I tried to make out the shape of my captor. Brandon stared back at me.
"You?"
I said, shocked not to see some hideous alien face. Stunned to see Brandon alive. Brandon fell to his knees.
"No," he said. "It's not possible."
He looked as bereft and lost as I felt. Then he lunged at me, yanking my wrist forward. He inspected the ID band in disbelief, then grabbed my shoulders and started shaking me so hard I thought I might throw up.
"How did you get this? How did you get this?"
I tried to answer, but he wouldn't let me. He just kept shaking me. When I couldn't take it anymore, I finally tipped over and retched all over the corrugated steel of the vehicle's floor. Brandon crawled back, away from my heaving. But by the time it had stopped, he was looking at me apologetically.
"Sorry."
"It's not your fault," I said. "I don't think it was you anyway. The fumes from the explosion made me sick. Made me pass out, I guess."
I moved to the other side of the still-moving vehicle, sat down, and explained how I'd come to be here. I told him how I'd stolen Daxon's ID band to get into the Chimera, and how I'd raced back to campus, only to find the place a tarry smear on the ground. Finished, I looked up at Brandon sheepishly. He was quiet for a minute, his expression impossible to read. Finally, he spoke.
"I never would have come back to the LDA if I'd known it was just you. It was a pointless risk."
Ouch.
"I came for Daxon. I just wasted hours exposed in the city, trying to locate Daxon, and all I find is you."
I felt my insides twist with shame.
"He might have gotten out. If he'd had his ID band, he might have lived," said Brandon, his anger rising. "When the first Mogadorian missile hit the grid, a warning was sent to us, the Academy's 9 Mentor Sepans. We were to immediately evacuate whatever structure we were in, to make our way to our assigned guard using their locator bands, retrieve them, and bring them back to the secret base. 8 of us succeeded. But Daxon must have slept right through the attack."
The evacuation plan Daxon had cryptically alluded to. I'd assumed it was just Lorian defense paranoia. But he'd known this was coming.
"I'm sorry,"
I croaked. The words sounded so pitiful, so puny, in light of the havoc and death I had created. All so I could go to a concert and mess around with Devectra. Now my city lay in ruins, and Daxon was dead. He would never complete the mission he'd spent his whole life preparing for.
"The Elder Pittacus designed the evacuation protocol many years ago, but we Mentor Sepans were given very little information, beyond the mere fact of our enrollment. Weeks ago, the Elders went off on a secret diplomatic mission, from which they've yet to return. They'd set the protocol to be activated preemptively if the Council lost touch with them during the course of their absence."
Brandon clutched his head.
"They were worried. From what little I've learned, a race of aliens called Mogadorians is coming. Has already come. The Elder prophecy has come to pass. We knew of the Mogadorians' existence, had even had some dealings with them long ago. But we never anticipated that they might prove hostile to us. I nodded along with him as he spoke, trying to absorb as much of what he was saying as I possibly could. "Lorien, as we knew it, has already ceased to exist," he said. "And," he added, punctuating himself with a bitter laugh, "we've already botched the evacuation. 9 Mentor Sepans. 9 Young Guard. Just as there are now 9 Elders. The number must matter. It must have been for a reason. With Daxon dead."
His voice trailed off. He turned towards the console at the front of the transport and sighed.
"We're almost at the airstrip," he said. "We'll just have to make do with 8.
The vehicle came to a stop and Brandon stepped out. I followed him outside. We were parked 50 yards from a small airstrip, deep in the outer territories. A medium-sized aircraft was parked in the distance. I could make out people congregating near the craft. Without a word to me, Brandon was charging away from the vehicle towards them. "Wait," I called. He turned around, an impatient look on his face. "The kid," I said. "What about the kid?" I already bore some, possibly all, of the responsibility for Daxon's death. But the boy had been earmarked for survival, and he was still out there. As far as I knew, the Malkin Kabaraks hadn't been hit yet.
"His mentor, Sepan, is already dead," said Brandon. "And even if he weren't, the trip there and back would take 2 hours. We need to be off this planet as soon as possible. It's too big a risk. And it's a risk that none of us, with guard of our own to protect, can afford to take."
"So the kid was doomed?" "I can't live with that," I said.
"You won't have to," said Brandon. "Not for long, anyway."
Fear gripped my heart, and I suddenly realized there was no place for me on the evacuation ship. I would perish along with the rest of the planet during the next wave of the attack. "So me, the kid, and everybody else on this planet, we're just fucked, huh?" I knew I sounded pathetic, but I couldn't help myself. "Left to die as the invasion begins?" Brandon didn't skip a beat.
"Yes," he said. "This is no longer about saving individual lives, Sandor. This is about saving an entire race."
So that was that.
"I'm sorry, Sandor," said Brandon, softening a little. "I have no reason to believe the Mogadorians will leave a single Lorien soul alive when they come. But for your sake, I hope."
Brandon drifted off, unable to finish his sentence. He didn't need to. I understood perfectly. Death would be better than the alternative. There was nothing left to say. "Okay, then," I said, pitifully sarcastic. I gave Brandon a little wave goodbye. "Guess I'll be seeing you." I was alone again. I'd fallen to my knees in the dirt by Brandon's vehicle. The only illumination came from its interior lights. Brandon hadn't bothered to close the door when he'd left it behind. I guessed there was no point when the entire planet was set for destruction. I twisted Daxon's ID band around the flesh of my wrist. It was amazing how much trouble this little device had caused. What a trivial and tragic mess I had made with it. Disgusted with myself and my own predicament, I pulled the band off and raised it over my head, ready to toss it into the darkness.
I hesitated, thinking of Devectra. I wondered where she was, if she had found any other guard to help her. I wondered if she was still alive, knowing that even if she was, her chances of survival, even with her legacies, would be slim to none. Really, death was probably the best thing that could happen to her. She wouldn't give a shit about that. We were too alike that way. She didn't believe in perfect. That would be her strength. I decided it would be mine too. If I was going down, I was going to make it as messy as I could.
Nine young guard, Brandon had said. That must have been for a reason.
Yes, I thought, looking down at the ID band I was still clutching in my white-knuckled fist. Something had been set in motion a long time ago that had brought me to this point, on my knees in the Outer Territories, this ID band and locator in my hands. It's all for a reason. There had to be nine. Nine Saipan. Nine guard. I had fucked up so badly. It wasn't too late, though. I could still be good. Chapter 13. The vehicle rumbled and buckled over the unpaved earth, its course set for the Malkin Kabarak. With the thing on autopilot, I was free to dig around in the back, trying to find a weapon. I had no idea if the Mogadorian second wave would be another round of missile hits or a ground invasion, but I figured it wouldn't hurt to arm myself. Unfortunately, all I managed to find was a long, sharp knife. Not especially powerful, but it was something. I also grabbed a spare infomod, hoping that it might somehow come through with news of another attack. I booted it up, not expecting much, but it was still picking up scattered, patchy transmissions. The ones that were coming through were mostly dedicated to Muni's communications about rescue efforts in the city. They'd caught us off guard, just like the elders had predicted. Even now, people didn't seem to get it. Not a single one of the transmissions I was able to hear made any reference to the fact that we'd been attacked, or the fact that it wasn't over yet. Maybe the rest of Lorien was still mostly oblivious. I knew the truth, though. I knew what I had to do. I was going to save the boy, or die trying. The vehicle pulled up to the edge of Malka, and I made my way up the dirt path in the dark. I couldn't see much, but I let my memory guide me towards the hut the boy had shared with his grandfather. The closer I got, the more the locator band vibrated, signaling that I was heading in the right direction. In the distance, I could hear the hubbub of the Malkin's quartermoon revels. They still didn't know. For a brief moment, I considered running onto the Kabarak and warning them about the upcoming invasion, telling them to arm themselves. But I didn't have time for that, and it wouldn't make any difference anyway. I had to keep my focus. This was about the survival of our whole race. Brandon had said there had to be nine. When I reached the hut, the boy, his grandfather, and the frolicking Chimera were nowhere to be seen, but the band continued to vibrate in my hand. By moving forward in a couple different directions, testing the vibration's frequency, I was able to get a bead on him. He was farther up the path. I rounded a crest that gave out to a narrow field among other hills. A large campfire blazed nearby, and as I moved closer, I saw the boy's grandfather crouched next to it. He looked up at me. The boy and his Chimera were nowhere to be seen. The man gestured at the seat beside him. Nervously, I stepped forward and took my place at the campfire. Whatever he was cooking, it smelled delicious. It was nearly dawn, and I hadn't eaten since dessert the night before. Teased by the smell, my mouth began to water. The man gestured at the pot.
"Eat," he said.
I did as I was told, using the stone ladle jutting out of the pot to fill a small earthenware bowl with the rich stew. It's delicious, I said, nodding with gratitude.
You've come for my boy, said the grandfather.
Yes, I said, realizing that he had known why I was there all along.
He is all I have, he said. Anyone can see that there is something special about him. My gift allows me rare glimpses at the threads of destiny, and I have always known this day would come. The day I met you, I could see that it wouldn't be long.
Daxon's ID band hadn't stopped vibrating crazily since I'd sat down, and now my tab was going off like crazy. Here by the campfire with this strong, simple man staring me down, I felt like a tech-addled slob. 1 second, I said, feeling like a total idiot. Excuse me. I stood, pulled the mod out of my pocket and looked down, reading the newest update. Approach of second wave confirmed. Missile attack followed by ground forces. Some surviving LDF warrior or perhaps a Muni's employee had managed to make it onto the comm network and had finally managed to sound out the real alarm. I was still wondering what it all meant when I felt my legs give out from under me. The mod went flying out of my hands and landed with a thud on the ground. But it was only the boy who'd lunged at my legs and knocked me onto the ground. He was stronger than he looked, and he knew it. He threw himself onto his back in the grass and giggled with wild pride, the metal band on his wrist glinting under the firelight.
Gotcha,
the boy exclaimed. I wondered if he would remember this night, and if he did, whether he would remember with sadness what he was about to lose, or with happiness for what, for a few more moments at least, he still had. I mustered up a smile in response. Not yet, pal. I retrieved my mod from where it had landed in the grass and picked myself up, kneeling in the dirt with the fire at my back. I opened my arms and the boy ran into them unquestioningly. I scooped him up and stood, and as I did, I looked over at his grandfather just for a moment. He stared back at me with a great sadness. I knew I had to leave, but I had to ask him one more thing. You said your legacy allows you to see people's destinies, I said. Can you see anything now?
He will be important, the man said sadly. That's all I know.
What about me? I asked. The man smiled sadly.
You will be important also, he said, but you will die.
I knew he was right. It was okay, though. We were all going to die. At least I would do it, making a difference. As I walked away, back down the path to the van, the boy's arms wrapped around my neck, I looked over my shoulder and took one last look at the face of the man who had raised him. It was streaming with tears that ran in deep furrows through the caked dust on his cheeks and into his beard. And then the second wave of missiles came down, booming in the distance. Chapter 14. The ground on the trail was uneven under my feet as I raced down the path, the branches and brambles scratching my face in the dark. I cursed under my breath and stumbled at every third step. The kid in my arms had started to cry as soon as his grandfather had disappeared from view, but he was doing it quietly. It's okay, I said, rubbing his back. It's okay, little guy. It wasn't okay. But maybe things would be better someday. For the kid in my arms, if not for me. First, though, I had to get him to the evacuation site without getting us both killed on the way. That was going to be easier said than done. I gasped when I emerged from the trees into the clearing near the hut and saw the sky. It was as bright as day. Bright blue, punctuated with quick fire bursts of pastel pinks and purples all up and down the horizon. It was like the entire world was on fire. Maybe it was. The explosions were coming faster than I could count. I couldn't stop to think about it. Panic wasn't going to do me any good, and there would be plenty of time for mourning later. Brandon and the evacuation ship would be leaving soon if it hadn't already left. There had to be 9 Guard. Brandon had said it, and somehow I knew it in my gut. I had to get him to the ship before takeoff. The vehicle was just up ahead. One step at a time. When I strapped the kid in next to me and fired up the autopilot system, the screen on the console lit up in a sea of red. The system was still linked in to an LDF satellite that was reading conditions all over the planet, and the devastation already wrought across the surface of Lorien, rendered in blinking red patches on the screen, had most routes back to the evacuation airstrip looking risky at best. The route I'd taken to get here was completely obstructed. With that no longer an option, it seemed like my best bet was to pass through Malka, and then rejoin the original route at its midpoint. I fired up the autopilot, cranked it up to the highest speed it could achieve, and took a deep breath. It would either work, or it wouldn't. The engine began to whir. The vehicle lurched forward, and we went hurtling out into the burning night. Then I turned to the still crying kid. I had no experience with children. I wasn't even a Mentor Saipan trainee. Once I dropped him off at the airstrip, he would go on to whatever his great destiny was and would cease to be my problem. But I hated hearing him cry. I looked him in the eye, and he gasped for breath a little bit, as his wails became weaker. It was like he didn't want me to see him like this. It was like he was trying to be brave. "Listen, kid," I said. When I spoke, his sobs got even quieter. "Things are going to be a little dicey for a little bit. You need to be brave. You're a guard, you know? Someday you're going to have a lot of power. You'll be able to be whoever you want to be. But first, you need to keep your chin up. After all, you're the future of the whole damn Lorien race, right?" The boy was looking at me intently now, no longer crying at all. He was hanging on my every word, his eyes wide and his small mouth formed into a tiny O. "You got it, buddy?" I asked. "We need you." He gave me a stern look and waved his fist in my face. "Cow, cow," he said. "Yep," I said, smiling. "Cow, cow is right." "Squonk! Squonk!" Instinctively, my hands flew to cover my ears. The boy yelped. It was the sound of some kind of horn, deep and booming. It rumbled up through the wheels of the van, right up into my bones. I had a feeling I knew what it was, the sound of a Mogadorian ship. There was nothing else it could be. This was not good. I checked the console. We were getting there, but we still had a ways to go. The road ahead of us was littered with rubble, fallen trees, and dead bodies every here and there. I tried not to look at them. To the right was a void in the sky where the Elkin spires had once been. In the distance, the smoking ruins of Capital City were getting closer. We had just reached Eilon Park, on the outskirts of the city, when we were hit. I'm not sure what got us. It wasn't a missile, or else we would be dead.
It might have been flying debris from a bomb. It might have been something else. It really doesn't matter. Whatever it was, a massive blast knocked against the van and sent us flying. Everything went dark. I came to on my back. My head was bleeding and my vision was blurred. There was some horrible grinding squeak above my head. The boy was kneeling over me, looking down into my eyes with a concerned expression.
"Cow, cow?"
he asked. I looked up past him to see the bottom of the van, the seats, the center console, above me. I was lying with my back against the interior roof. We were upside down. In pain, I moved my head and could see, through a freshly smashed window, the grass of the park. I didn't know what we were going to do. There was no way we were going to be able to get the van right side up again, much less running. I climbed through the shattered window, ignoring the glass that scratched my arms. When I was through, I turned around, reached out, and yanked the boy through with me. We rolled back into the grass together, out of breath.
Squonk! Squonk!
That noise again. Suddenly, next to me, the kid's eyes widened. His jaw dropped. I flipped around and saw the monster standing right above us. So close, I could smell the stink of his breath. It was the ugliest thing I'd ever seen, probably a full 2 heads taller than me, with pale white skin and a mouth jammed full of tiny, crooked teeth that were pointier and sharper than knives. I know what his teeth looked like, because he was smiling. At his side, a giant curved sword dangled. This, I knew, was a Mogadorian. He growled at us with narrowed eyes. The noise was low and menacing, throaty and guttural. The beast raised its sword over its head. I had tried. I had. We had almost made it. Now, it was over. There was no use pretending my body would make any real shield for the kid. We would both die from the same blow. Then I heard the strangest thing. It was something like music. I recognized it. Before I could react, there was a giant flash of light, and the music got louder. So loud that it sounded like it was coming from inside my skull. It was Devectra's song. It was beautiful. The Mogadorian reeled backward and dropped his sword. His face twisted into a horrified mask of pain. He let out another growl, really more of a roar, and fell to his knees. I didn't even think about it. I knew what I had to do. I sprang to my knees, grabbed the sword, and with dazzling white lights flashing all around me, swung it with every bit of strength that I had. A geyser of blood erupted into the air as his head went flying. I never saw her. I don't know how she found us, or why she didn't reveal herself. There probably just wasn't time. But it was her. Devectra had saved me. More important, she had saved the boy. He stood up, looked at me quizzically, seemingly unfazed by what had just happened, and pointed to something that was lying in the grass a few yards away. "Motorcycle?" he asked.